we're on. This is the Sunday evening review session, and enough said. This is a beautiful day. Welcome to October. Isn't it nice out today? Did you all get out? You tried to study outside? Yeah. I didn't try, but the lake was beautiful, and then the wind died. So we motored back. Went apple picking with my favorite 7-year-old. And tomorrow's supposed to be 80. And Tuesday is supposed to be 80 and sunny. And next weekend is supposed to be 50 and sunny. Okay. So now I just have to find somebody else to give the exam tomorrow, and I'll go sailing again, and we're okay. Okay. Did you all get the email that I sent about the review sessions and things being on the web? And no? Yes. Okay. I hope it says 3:35. This room is 3:15, so. My wife asked me the other day if I had had any nightmares recently, and all of my nightmares are about making mistakes like that, telling people the wrong room for an exam, and things like that. So, hopefully I didn't. But you think I did it right. All right, we'll see. I'll go back and check. Okay, questions about the exam first. The introductory lectures or the introductory section of the text? Yes. Yeah. Anything that we did in lecture is likely to be on the exam. Anything in the text is likely to be on the exam, except the theorists at the beginning and research techniques and those sorts of things won't be on the exam. This one. Yes. You. Yeah. Can you make a person taller than her genetic potential? What do you think? Yes? How could you do that?
Growth hormones.
Hmm? Growth hormone. No, it's wrong. Okay. You can make a person taller, but not taller than her genetic potential. That it's a trick question. And it gets repeated in each of the other two units. And what it does is call your attention to the fact that what your genes give you is a physiological range of possibilities. And if you can do it, it's within your potential. There's no such thing as an overachiever. An overachiever is defined as somebody who does better than his or her potential. That's absurd. I mean, you can't do better than your potential. If you can do it, it was potential. And what they mean in that case with overachievers is better than the prediction that was made from some test. In the case of growth and anything else in this course, if you can do it, it's within your potential. On the CD. The question is, are the questions on the exam similar to the ones on the CD? Yes, with the exception that the CD quizzes, the multiple choice parts, a fair number of those are what I call definitional, and I don't ask definitional questions usually. on the exam. So the simpler questions on the CD quizzes, I won't ask simple questions like that typically on our exam. I give you more credit than that. The essays, I actually don't remember on the CD, are there essay questions? Okay. So our essay questions are more like the study questions or the writing, the one writing exercise that we did at the end of class a couple of weeks ago. So I also put, in case you haven't checked it out yet, I put a few sample essay questions at the end of the Unit 1 overheads. If you were looking for them, that's where they are. They're at the end of that big section that's the Unit 1. And right at the very end, I put, I think, half a dozen, maybe five, typical essay questions. And those are, for the most part, ones that I have used in the past and probably will not use tomorrow. But to give you an idea of the nature of the questions.
Yes.
On the website.
What yeah. is the address for the website?
uvm.edu/tildeLShelton. And then you get my web page, and then there's a link there to 5. There's also a link to 60. And then you get, if you click on 5, you get to the news page for this course, and then that links to everything else. You don't need Freud or Erickson, Piaget for this unit. I think, if I recall correctly, in the introductory couple of chapters of the text, I don't think any of the people that are described there or mentioned there are covered in the biological development section. I've talked about Esther Thalen, I talked about Myrtle McGraw in lecture, and I don't think either of them are mentioned in the introductory section. Esther Thalen is mentioned in the text. Myrtle McGraw is not. And if I talk about them in lecture, they're likely to be important. What we'll do for the other two units starting next Wednesday is go back and look at, I'll ask you to reread the sections of that chapter on theorists that are pertinent. Myrtle McGraw was a psychologist who studied motor development in children. She's the one who did the experiment where she took twins in normal families and took one of each pair of twins and put the kid in an enriched kind of baby gym experience for play two or three times a week. And what she demonstrated was that by giving kids extra experience of things that they enjoyed doing, like crawling up ramps and stairs and eventually climbing on towers and ladders and that kind of thing, that their motor skills were accelerated. That they were superior to their stay-at-home twins. That would be potentially a multiple choice question or two. It might be useful in answering one of the essays or two of the essays as an example if one of them seemed appropriate. I wouldn't ask you in an essay question, what did Myrtle McGraw do? That would be too simple, too straightforward.
Who's Esther Thalen?
Esther Talen is a psychologist who also studied motor development in children and particularly infants, and is described in the text. Her approach is described in the text. The essence of her conclusions from her studies, and she's spent a great deal of many years looking at how motor development happens. She just died this past year. She is described in the text as having concluded that the baby and the environment are part of a single system. That the baby is developing within an environment that makes certain things possible and encourages certain things, motor skills. And you can't really, in her view, you couldn't really talk about developing motor skills without talking about the environment in which those motor skills are being developed, because it's that environment that the child is adapting to. And that's quite consistent with Myrtle McGraw, which is why I talked about Myrtle McGraw at the same time, because she had demonstrated that the environment encourages or doesn't encourage motor skills. The other part of Esther Talen's work is that she described motor skills as essentially a self-organizing system. She says nobody really teaches a child to walk. What you do is take advantage of the fact that children are evolved to walk, and that as they develop, they will exercise the muscles. They will build a skeleton and a nervous system that permit walking if they're in an environment that allows them to stand upright. So what you do as an adult caregiver is give the kid the opportunity. You create an environment in which the child has the opportunity to be upright and strengthen the legs. And eventually the kid will put walking together, because that's what we're evolved to do. And it won't learn to fly. It'll learn to walk. It probably won't learn without extra effort. It probably won't learn to walk on its hands. It'll figure out that its feet work pretty well and that it can support its weight, and then it'll walk. So she... why is that important? It's important because some approaches to development take the simplistic view that everything a child learns is taught. And Thalen and other people pay more attention to the evolved biological characteristics of the infant and child. And their argument is that we have evolved to learn the skills that are going to be adaptive in the expectable environment. And that if you have feet and legs, and you have a spine and hips, you're probably going to learn to walk upright, and you're going to do that without a lot of direct tuition. Nobody is going to teach you directly to put one foot in front of the other. When you have 2 feet and they bend the way our legs do, that's what they're for, and kids will discover that if they have the opportunity to be upright. So it's not a matter of teaching a kid to walk forward. How else would you do it? And that's an important position to take, because it applies not just to walking or other motor skills, but to language and thinking and probably relationships, that we are evolved to develop particular kinds of approaches to the world. And that's what we do. And you don't need to have a fancy theory about how to get a kid to become sociable. Kids are built to be sociable. They're built to pay attention to other human beings. They're built to imitate. That's what we do. Yes. No. The question is whether you need to be able to reproduce the whole course of prenatal development. I wouldn't ask that kind of question, like what happens on the seventh day. Or what I'm looking for are trends. You should know somewhat the sequence, and you should specifically know the three phases as the text describes them. Prenatal development is divided into three phases, and the first phase is not on that particular list that I made, but the text refers to the germinal phase. And the germinal phase germ meaning beginning. The germinal phase is the period between conception and implantation. And that phase is unique because the conceptus is the technical name, the what will become a baby, is not growing. It's differentiating. But it's not getting any bigger because it doesn't have any source of nutrients. And it's not at that point, until the end of the germinal phase, it's not developing an identifiable embryo. It's not directly attached to the mother. With implantation, as that begins about the sixth day, then you start the embryonic phase. And that's the phase during which the embryo is differentiated and all of its parts begin. And that lasts for the next couple of months until all of these organ systems have begun. And then it becomes a fetus. So the second phase is embryonic, the third is fetal, the fetal period. And the fetal period is, there's nothing new beginning, but things are being completed and growth is happening, and then that ends with delivery. And then you become a newborn. Going back to the original question. So what you ought to know is that the embryonic period is the period during which the conceptus is more vulnerable than the fetus is, because things are more vulnerable when they're just beginning. So if you get sick or have an infection, or if the mother is particularly stressed, and the chemical environment for the embryo is harmful, then that's going to have more devastating effects during the embryonic period, because it may interfere with things that are just beginning rather than things that are growing. And if you mess up something when it's just beginning, you can distort its development or make it not happen at all. You should know a little bit about what's happening later in pregnancy. Should have some sense of what 6 and 7 and 8 month fetuses might be able to do. Have some sense of when a fetus might be able to survive outside the uterus by looking at the characteristics of the fetus. What does it need? Yes. Yep.
Is that
Can I answer that? Yeah. The question is, from the focus questions, when do boys and I'm sorry. How is it? How are they different? And when do they become? When does that become? When do the differences become important? Several part answer. Boys and girls are, or male and female, are different in at least one minor way from conception on, because the male has an X chromosome and a Y chromosome, the female has two X's. So genetically they're different from the very beginning. The major differences prenatally begin when the SRY gene on the male, on the Y chromosome, the SRY gene becomes active and initiates a whole cascade of changes in the male embryo. And that happens about 7 weeks or so after conception. And at that point, several things happen so that the male and female embryos have a different chemical environment. The SRY gene causes the male embryo to create a lot of androgenic substances, male hormones. And the genitalia then, and the gonad, what will become the testes, differentiate. So the embryos, male and female, are identical until that SRY gene becomes active. This was all in the video that we saw. So the embryos are identical except genetically, but physically they're identical until the SRY gene becomes active in the male and causes the male's development to diverge. If we didn't have the SRY gene, we'd all grow up female. But because the SRY gene kicks things off, instead of developing ovaries, you develop testes. Instead of a vagina and clitoris, you develop a penis. And probably at that same time, I always have to inhibit the tendency, the real inclination to say, at that point the male brain becomes weird or different. But we really don't know how. But it's probable that at that point, which is a point of very rapid brain differentiation, that probably that chemical difference between the male and female embryos, probably that has impact in the brain. And then there aren't really any differences for the rest of development between male and female babies and children. They're all pretty much the same except for the external genitalia. Probably the activity level difference is important. There are some other minor differences at birth that probably are significant. The big difference then that becomes really important is the difference that happens at puberty. And that one you should recall from the description of puberty. Puberty gets kicked off the same in males and females. The adrenal cortices do the same thing. The hypothalamus and pituitary do the same thing, and then the adrenal cortices secrete the same hormones in both males and females. But because we have different gonads, the males have testes and the females have ovaries, they respond to those hormones from the pituitary and from the adrenal cortices differently. And they in both cases, they elaborate and differentiate and become functional. But the female, the ovaries, are creating estrogen and then progesterone after ovulation, the testes are secreting testosterone. And all the secondary differences between us, how hairy we are, how big we are, how muscular we are, how much hemoglobin we have in our bloodstream, the length of our vocal cords, and probably some other changes in the brain, but certainly those physical differences become much greater. I mean, they don't really exist earlier, but as a result of puberty, because males have the testosterone and females have the ovaries secreting estrogen, we become very different. And those differences, then the physical differences become really important, because our reproductive roles are different then. Puberty makes it possible for us to reproduce, and we have different roles in that process. And then if our social roles haven't been terribly different, and in some cultures they're not, after puberty they are. You know, the social roles are very different because of the reproductive roles. Yes? Are you going to need to know a lot of specifics about the hormones? Probably not, beyond what I just said. You should know that the adrenal cortices in both males and females secrete the same hormones, both androgens and estrogens, and they have pretty much the same effects in both males and females. You should know that males and females are really different because the gonads are different and they secrete very different hormones. Testosterone and estrogen have very different impact on the two. So the big difference between us is the gonads.
You said with boys the SRY gene becomes active and different chemicals in the embryonic gene. What about girls? Is it just not that?
You don't get any. It's our party. The question was, the girls just not get that. And the SRY gene specifically exists only on the Y chromosome, and there is no specific different gene that causes female development that I'm aware of. We just got over my head in developmental genetics. That's all I know. So I could be wrong, and if you take developmental genetics and I'm wrong, tell me so I can change it, but change what I say. But there are probably a lot of genes on the X chromosome for both male and female that cause a lot of the development, growth in the reproductive system, growth of the gonadal streak, all of that. But it's all the same in both males and females, as far as I know. It's the SRY gene that has been identified as the one that is responsible for the differentiation of male and female. And without that, if that's non-functional, for example, you can have a male, and you won't need to know this, but I wanted to give the background. You can have a male who has X and Y chromosomes, clearly genetically male, but with a defective SRY gene. Though there are males in whom the SRY gene doesn't work, and they don't differentiate into males. They're genetically male, but they don't end up with testes and penis. So that differentiation doesn't happen. And it's usually a chromosomal defect. It's broader usually than just the SRY. But if you don't have that SRY gene, then all the male stuff doesn't happen.
Isn't there, can't it
Depends on what you mean by boy stuff. Well, that's a much more complex issue. The SRY gene is perhaps implicated in cognitive differences between male and female, but that's not clear. There's probably a that plus some other important prenatal influences on brains that cause us to use them differently. And there's some fun stuff in that. I'm sort of trying to figure out how far to go. I teach a course on boys and men, so and I do workshops on the differences between boys and girls for teachers, so it's an important area. One of the things we do know, for example, is that at some point, and we don't know when because we don't have the research that will tell us, at some point, males and females typically, most of us, but not all of us, use the two hemispheres of our brain differently. So, for example, in dealing with verbal and emotional content, women are likely to use both halves of the brain when they're processing that information. We don't know how early that starts, just because we don't have the research. Men are likely to focus when they're doing that kind of task. They'll use one side of the brain. So women are using both sides when men are using one. If you look at spatial relations tasks, women also tend to use both halves of their brain, and men tend to use one, and it's the other one from what they're doing when they do emotional or verbal tasks. So we say that the male brain is more compartmentalized, or the two hemispheres are more differentiated. But again, we don't know when that starts. We also know that about 20% of women use their brains the way that typical men do, and about 20% of men use their brains more as women do. And those men and women, that 20%, have somewhat different cognitive styles than other men or women. We also know that in some studies, it's not clear all of them, but in some studies, the higher a mother's androgen level, the androgens from her adrenal cortex, the higher that level is during pregnancy, the better her daughter's spatial relations skills are. But there's no relationship for males. And so if you just look before delivery, if you look at the amount of androgen in the amniotic fluid and in the mother's bloodstream, the higher that is, the better the daughter's spatial relations abilities later on will be. But mother's androgen levels aren't related to males' spatial relations ability. We also know that for women who are physically active and do large motor stuff, their spatial relations are better too. So the spatial relations ability of men may not be chemical. It may really be based on activity in space. And women who engage in large motor activity in space may have better spatial relations ability because their brains are adapting to the practical spatial relations that they need for wrestling and jumping and running and playing basketball and those sorts of things. They're applying, they're interpreting. The question is, if they're not defining, what are they? They're applying, they're interpreting, understanding, There are probably other categories that I'm not thinking of, but they're more complex than just, you know, male hormones are called androgens. I wouldn't ask that kind of question. That's a definitional question. And I just try not to ask those. I expect you to know the definitions, but use them. Yes? The first and second chapter, I wish Julie were here to keep me honest, and two heads are better than one. First and second chapters, I suspect that there is probably, out of the 50 multiple choice questions, there is probably no more than one from the first two chapters. I wouldn't spend a lot of time memorizing the first two chapters. And if there are two, forgive me. How specifically should you know the adaptations at birth? You should know that they are. You should know why they are. And you probably should be able to give a brief summary of which organs are involved. You don't need to know specifically what kidneys do. I'm sorry? What are adaptations? Changes. Adaptation is a word generally that refers to change in response to some changing environmental condition, or you know, because something has happened, you have to change the way you do things, and that is called an adaptation. You adapt by changing the way you do things. Yes? Breathing at birth?
Yeah.
It's very necessary.
Right.
Right.
Well, how it changes?
How it changes? Before birth, there is no air in the uterus. The lungs are filled to a certain degree, I think 40% is the figure on one of my overheads, with fluids that are created by the lungs, and otherwise they have amniotic fluid in them because the fetus has been breathing in and out amniotic fluid. It's underwater. It's expanding its chest. It's using those muscles from sometime in that prenatal, that course of prenatal development. At some point, it's making breathing movements, but what it's breathing in and out is the amniotic fluid. So it's breathing underwater, but it's not absorbing anything from the amniotic fluid. Where's it getting its oxygen? Through the umbilical cord, from the oxygen in the mother's blood, from her lungs, is dissolved in her blood, and is being extracted from her blood at the placental barrier, coming into the fetus's blood, and so the fetus's blood is being oxygenated in the placenta, and it gets enough oxygen that way. At birth, the placenta is unplugged, comes apart from the uterine wall, so it doesn't have that, and the fetus needs oxygen pretty quickly. So what happens during the birth process is a couple of things. One is that the stress hormones, that it's because of the compression of contractions, the babies become agitated, and as it's become agitated, when it comes out, a couple of things are going to happen. It's going to start gasping and it's going to expel the amniotic fluid that's in its lungs. So it's going to create room for air, and with that very first gasp, it goes, out comes the fluid, and then it goes, and in comes air. And the lungs immediately begin to extract oxygen from the air, dissolve it in the newborn's bloodstream. And then over the first few minutes, what typically is happening is the baby is crying, gasping, wheezing, and you know, get this stuff out of my lungs, I want air in there. One of the first things in an assisted birth, if you have a midwife or a nurse or a doctor, they've got a suction device, bulb, and they squeeze it, shove it down in the throat and in the nostrils, and release it, which sucks out any fluid and gunk that's in there. And then over the next 2 or 3 days, the fluid is going to drain out and be absorbed by the lungs and be replaced by air. And one of the reasons babies cry is to fill their lungs with air. So it's getting its air from the lungs. That's probably more than you wanted to know. But that's what's happening. Yes, the question is, would there be a problem with C-sections because you're not getting the compressions? The baby is not stressed, typically, particularly in a planned C-section. Yeah. Planned C-section, you sedate the mother, the baby's calmed by that. Anything that calms the mother calms the baby. And you do your incision, and you remove this wonderful fetus that sort of looks at you and is kind of sleepy and then it doesn't like the light. And its head is normal. But it's not likely to be stressed except by being out, having its temperature suddenly change, having light, and all kinds of... Think about it. It's really, really weird to have been in water all of your existence, and here you are in the air. You know, it's got to be really weird. So I think they probably get a little excited about that. Holy smoke, what are they doing to me now? But the important point that you've raised is that C-section babies are less vigorous, they're less likely to cry. The placenta is typically intact unless it's an emergency C-section and hasn't had the contractions to loosen it, to separate it. So the baby's not oxygen deprived, typically. It's still getting oxygen from the placenta until the umbilical cord shuts down. So C-section babies are more likely to get patted on the bottom. Vaginally delivered babies typically don't need to be patted on the bottom. They are typically held up because for two reasons. One is that if you're trying to hold a baby when it's first born, what you've done is catch this incredibly slippery little wiggly thing, and they're very slippery, and so what you typically are going to do with something like that is grab it by the ankles, because you can get both ankles firmly in your hand, and then if you've got it firmly in your hand, well, why not hold it up, you know? And like a chicken, you know, there. But one reason that you're doing that is to help the fluid drain, because water runs downhill. So if you hold the infant up, if you hold the newborn up, it's more likely to get some of that fluid out of its lungs. But typically they're also supporting its head rather than letting it dangle. So if it's not breathing, then you're going to do something to stimulate it. And a sharp whack on the butt is one of the things that, or traditionally, you don't want to hit it in the head. So, you know, sometimes they get a little, just shake them a little, but it's easier just to go whap. And sometimes that startles them into starting to, what am I doing? I just got born, now they're hitting me? It should be the only time the baby ever gets hit. On my viewpoints, you should know what a developmental perspective is. You should know what a transactional perspective is, because I've talked about those two or three times. The constructivist is a little less important in this unit, but very important in the next unit. Developmental, transactional, contextual, constructivist, and applied, which I probably won't ask you about application. Just a perspective of mine is I'm interested in how you use this stuff, not just, I want the useful information. And tomorrow morning, but not tonight, I actually defined those this morning. I reviewed the main points and realized that they were not definitions. I won't ask you for a definition, but I might ask you what a transactional viewpoint would say about something. So tomorrow morning I'll update the website main points to include those definitions, because I realized that I had labeled them but not defined them. I'm trying to think if there are questions that do refer to those, and there are a couple that do. The review session will be posted tomorrow. The other two are already up. Wednesday's lecture is up, and I did Friday's review session yesterday, and I'll do this one tomorrow morning at some point. Unless I'm feeling particularly, tomorrow morning. Yeah. I'm tired. I was outside all the. Yeah. I'm sorry. What happens with circulation at birth? Yeah. What happens is that, as I said a few minutes ago, the oxygen for the fetus is coming from the mother's blood, from her lungs, through her blood, through the placenta and umbilical cord to the fetus. Nutrients are also coming that way. So the primary source of oxygenated blood is the placenta and the umbilical cord. In order for that blood to be circulated efficiently in the fetus, it passes, some of it, not all of it, some of it passes from one of the upper chambers to the other and back down the body. So the two upper chambers of the heart are connected. There's a hole between the foramen ovale. You don't have to know that, but there's an opening between the two chambers of the heart, and that allows that oxygenated blood not to go up through the lungs, but to come down through the rest of the body and distribute the oxygen and nutrients throughout the fetus's body. At birth, the umbilical cord shuts down, so nothing is happening there, and the vein that comes up with the oxygenated blood to the heart stops having oxygenated blood, and it becomes unimportant at that point. And what becomes really important is getting the blood through the lungs down into the heart with oxygen and get that distributed. So the opening between the two chambers, the upper chambers of the heart, needs to close off so that the blood coming down from the lungs with oxygen doesn't get recirculated through the lungs until it's gone through the rest of the body. Okay. So what's happening is that the direction of blood flow in the upper chambers of the heart is changing. And that's because the oxygen is now coming from the lungs instead of the umbilical cord. And you want that blood to go down through the arteries from the heart. That's the biggest change. The other, of course, is that the umbilicus shuts down, so there's no blood flowing through the placenta. And those are the two big changes. Mothers, are they important? No, a very good question. Do you need to know about the mother's development during pregnancy? Not beyond what is in the text. I'm not expecting you to have studied the journal in the online version of the video, so you're not responsible for that. It's interesting. What goes on, but we're not covering it. There are a few little details, but actually the text doesn't talk about pregnancy from the woman's point of view in particular detail. That's a shortcoming of the text, I think. I think beyond knowing that the mother's kidneys and liver and lungs are doing all the, and digestive system are providing all that service to the fetus, we're giving it short shrift. But we probably should talk about it more. Because what's going on for the mother is very interesting. The transactions between the mother's body and the fetus or the embryo are very interesting. The mother's body is being, to some degree, taken over by the embryo, beginning with implantation and maybe even before, but that's fun stuff, but we haven't covered it. How long should the responses to the essay questions? Two sentences is probably too little. And what you will have is four questions. You did get that message right. I said six, four out of six. I said several times in lecture, and it wasn't until after Wednesday's lecture that Julie said, "Aren't we doing three out of four?" And I said, "Oh, yes, we're doing three out of four, not four out of six." So there'll be four essays, and you get to write three. And they will be on both sides of, and this is the part that when I go back to my office, I will have been told by her whether we are using 8.5 by 11 or 8.5 by 14 sheets of paper. So you'll have half a sheet of paper, whichever size it is, for each question. So, like that. And I would advise to answer the question and then elaborate on your answer and maybe give an example or make sure that you've explained it. As I said in a previous review session, one of the difficulties is that people write a couple of sentences and assume they've said everything. They may have said everything they know, but not everything they could have said about the question. And most of the questions can't really be answered in a sentence or two and give enough detail that lets us know what you know. So assume we don't know anything and you have to teach us everything you know about the particular question. Because we can't fill in with what we know and assume that you knew that. So elaborate and outline an answer, jot down some notes about what you think should be included, and then write it. And then after you've written it, go back and be your own editor and say, okay, how could I expand on this? Because clearly, as long as you're in the right ballpark, the more information you provide, as long as it's on the topic, the better. Don't throw in random stuff, but make sure that you've explained it fully enough. And one way I recommend doing that is to think about, after you've written your answer and thought about it, then think about me standing there saying, tell me more about what you mean. Okay, so if you want to have that nightmare tonight, just think about the image of me standing there saying, tell me more about what you mean. Make sure I understand it. Yes?
In the first chapter, how important are the things on genetics and things that can happen on the chromosomes and all the abnormalities and that sort of thing?
Yeah. The question is, how important are the specifics of genetics and genetic and chromosomal abnormalities? We won't ask much at all about the specifics. I'm interested in how genes work and what they are and how they work. I'm not going to ask about what kind of disorder is PKU, or is Down syndrome, what kind of chromosomal abnormality is Down syndrome. You've got the book. If you needed to look it up, you would. It's not a course on genetic abnormalities, so you don't need to know the specifics of those. You should know how they operate, so if you have the gene for a particular disorder, you ought to be able to say something about why you would have that particular disorder. How would that work? I'm sorry? All disorders?
Like abnormalities.
All? No. No. Complex answer, and I don't want to go too deeply into it because I can't. But many disorders are many of the genetic disorders are present in either male or female. In some, there are dominant forms and recessive forms, but you can get the dominant from either parent and the recessive, or the recessive from either parent. And then it's a problem if you get it from both. The only ones that the sex of the parent makes a difference is those genetic disorders that are either on or activated by the X and Y chromosomes. Okay. So if a disorder affects only males, for example, or only females, then it's a sex-linked disorder. But most disorders are not particularly sex-linked. They're present, and you get them from one parent or the other, or both. There are a couple of interesting ones. just very briefly. If you're interested, I'll tell you about it. There's a disorder of the sex chromosomes in which males and it depends on which parent you get your X chromosome from. And what that means is that the X chromosome from mother and the X chromosome from father operate differently. And it's a fun kind of characteristic, because you can get it if you're a girl with only one X chromosome, which is called Turner syndrome. You can get that X from the mother or from the father. And Turner syndromes with their X chromosome from their fathers are different psychologically from Turner syndrome girls who got their X from their mothers. They have different personalities. And that's really weird. I happened in this course 2 years ago, I had a student in the course who had Turner syndrome and knew which parent she got her X chromosome from. And after I said something about that in class, she came up afterward and said, "Yeah, that's me. I got mine from mom."
How helpful are the guideposts questions?
The guidepost questions, I think, are a very good way to review the material. I have not gone directly to them to pull multiple choice or essay questions, but there's clearly overlap. But they are useful. And someday I will actually go through them and pull questions from them. But they're a nice summary of the chapters.
Is the brain development important when it comes to how it develops through pregnancy?
Is brain development important? Yes, you should know a bit about how the brain develops, various aspects of that. Not in huge detail, but I did go over different ways the brain changes in lecture. Synaptic pruning and cell pruning and cell growth and development of circuits and pathways. So you should know a little bit about that.
Maybe more questions on pregnancy and infancy than middle age.
Will there be more questions on pregnancy and infancy than adulthood? Probably yes. I haven't counted, so don't hold me to it. But there clearly are questions about adulthood and aging. So they are there, and adolescence. So the exam covers the whole lifespan. But we've spent a lot more time on the early parts.
With the growth for menopause and the number of ovaries being recruited declining, would that be like a multiple choice? You give a certain year, and then we say how many would be recruited, or would that be?
No. Now, the question is, would I ask the kind of tricky question like, at what age do you have how many ova being recruited? No. Because I don't remember those things anyway. But what is important, I think, is the fact that you have all the primitive ova. I mean, they're not ova yet, but the oocytes. You have all of those you're going to have very early in pregnancy. And then the number declines, so you have fewer at birth, you have fewer at puberty. They become active, then they start getting matured or recruited to maturation beginning at puberty. So you have mature ova coming along then through the reproductive years, but the number of them being recruited continues from the mid-30s or so to decline, and that's why you're producing less estrogen as you go through middle adulthood. And the perimenopausal symptoms are because of the reduced estrogen. And then eventually you aren't recruiting any and don't have any left. And that's menopause. I'm sorry? I actually don't remember. But yeah, you're continuing to lose them. They're just being reabsorbed or withering up or whatever they do. I don't know what they actually do in the ovaries, but they're gradually being lost. And I don't remember what the figure is, how many you would typically have at puberty. The only number I'm sure about is that at menopause there aren't any left. None left to be recruited. I'm sorry.
One of the questions also, let's say, for you, you said it was just what is menopause, and who's potentially having it happen. So an example of answer to that too would be just the fact that they've lost over all the years, all the, and then less estrogen in your body, which causes menopause.
Right. Yeah. You might explain why there's less estrogen, but you just put what could be four or five sentences together in shorthand. Just fill them out a little bit. And I would add to your answer that one of the things that's happening, I think this is not in the text, and I may not have emphasized it, so it's probably not terribly important for tomorrow, but the communication between the hypothalamus and the pituitary that got established as a cycle at puberty begins to fall apart. The synchrony between the hypothalamus and the pituitary begins to, they get out of sync starting in the mid-30s. And that's part of the problem in perimenopausal symptoms. Women have difficulty maintaining body temperature at a steady state, so they get too warm, too cold. They have more difficulty sleeping at night because they sort of... We all go through cycles and of deep sleep and light sleep, and what happens with women is that when they get to light sleep, their metabolic rate goes up and their heart rate increases, so they wake up. So they surface, and then they may have trouble falling back asleep. And women are much more likely to have that kind of problem in the late 30s and 40s than they had earlier, and they are more likely to have sleep problems than men are. And they complain about that because we just go to sleep and my wife says, why don't you wake up in the middle of the night? And I say, because I have a clean conscience. And she says, so do I. But she worries, but she worries because she's awake and if she would just not surface. But middle-aged women can't do that. And they routinely have more difficulty, body temperature and other metabolic processes. The cyclic nature of the communication between the hypothalamus and pituitary is established during puberty. Because that's what's regulating your ovulatory and menstrual cycles. And men don't have the same kind of cycling on a monthly basis. We have some hormonal cycles, but there we have some daily cycles and we have some seasonal cycles, but our cycles are not clearly monthly in the way that women's are. And as far as I know, there isn't a single research study on whether or not we synchronize our cycles in the way that women synchronize their menstrual cycles if they live together.
What does the cycle do? The cycle comments
the okay, what the cycles are about the hormones that recruit or stimulate. Recruiting is the word we use, but the hormones that stimulate ovaries to elaborate ova. So that's under pituitary control. The ovaries don't operate just on their own. The pituitary secretes hormones that cause the ovaries to become active and to elaborate ova. The hypothalamus monitors almost all of your bodily activity, and it tells the one of the things it does is tell the pituitary that you have enough body fat and you're well nourished enough that it can go ahead and ovulate. If you're starving to death, you won't ovulate because the hypothalamus will say there's no point ovulating, we'd just be wasting ova now because we can't carry a baby to term. We can't feed it, so let's not have one, so let's not get pregnant because that would be even more depleting. So the hypothalamus is what's regulating whether or not you ovulate and whether or not you menstruate, whether you create the lining for the uterus. Because it's monitoring your metabolic processes generally and your nutritional status. So if your body is stressed, the hypothalamus is going to communicate that to the pituitary and say, don't recruit any ova. Don't. The male cycling is very minimal. Most men have a 24-hour cycle in which testosterone is secreted in the late night, early morning, and then declines. So the production of testosterone is less later in the day. This becomes very important to your fathers and your grandfathers. They're much more sexually capable in the morning than at night. And Dr. Ruth, you know, Dr. Ruth, the sex guru, if any of you ever heard her talk, she's absolutely wonderful. She was absolutely wonderful. She's about 5 feet tall and 4'11", and says it like it is. One of the things that she said as she got older that diurnal cycle, the 24-hour cycle of testosterone, is really important, and men are more likely to be able to get an erection in the morning. So if you're a woman and even morning isn't your best time, you might just have to change your schedule to keep him happy. If that's his best time, go ahead. Who says you can't have sex in the morning? Much less important for young men. That was more than you wanted to know, wasn't it? Okay. I won't be on the exam. I'm sorry.
Well, I don't know about flexing the schedule.
You what?
I don't know about flexing the schedule.
But Dr. Ruth had a particularly... bilateral... She was an equal opportunity sexual educator. She said, you know, if your interest is in having vigorous intercourse, then probably if you're the female and that might be your interest, then you need to strike while the iron is hot, so to speak, and that might, or while the man is hot, and that might be morning rather than night when he's really tired and stressed and just wants to go to bed. And in the morning, he hasn't had a drink. So he's going to be better. Evening after two martinis, he can't get it up anyway. So forget it then. So if your interest is your own pleasure, then morning may be the best time. That's a different course. That's HDFS 65.
Some
Yeah.
What changes are included in biological development? What sort of change are you looking for questions?
Well, those are study questions, so they are broad. I wouldn't ask most of those as an essay question. Although maybe, you know, I could in some way. I'm not likely to, but that's to get you to think about, well, what is included in biological development or physical development? What kinds of changes take place? And there are changes, huge number. Yeah, it's a huge question, but it's just to make you aware that you probably need to think about that. No, and most of the study questions don't have specific answers. Sometimes people get frustrated because there aren't answers in the book for them, but you know, they're really thought questions. You're all tired and you're going to get a good night's sleep. Okay. Eat breakfast and lunch tomorrow and bring a number two pencil. What? A number two pencil, yes. Yeah. If you don't, you'll be forced to borrow one or use one of those obnoxious little golf pencils without an eraser.
Thanks for having all these review sessions.
My job is to help.